I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Craft. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nara show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I.
We both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't silly, was I?
No, I think it was great, yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. Growing up, there was a familiar face on television who seemed to be a staple throughout childhood and adolescence. From his appearances as the flamboyant characters Fifi Bear and Clown in iconic children's shows such as The Magic Circle Club and Adventure Island, through to his daily appearances as an equally flamboyant entertainment reporter on The Mike Walsh Show, John Michael Hollywoodhausen was a joyous presence to audiences across the nation. He brought mirth, profiles of world stars, and champagne. Lots of champagne. It was therefore an absolute thrill to meet this iconic television legend, who figured so prominently in my early years of television viewing. And he didn't disappoint. John Michael Hausen worked as a journalist, starting in Mildura, Victoria, before moving to print and radio in Melbourne, where he became involved writing comedy sketches and songs for reviews, clubs, theatres and television. After several years working in the UK and Europe, he returned to Australia and created, wrote and performed in two of Australia's most beloved children's shows, the aforementioned multi-award winning The Magic Circle Club and Adventure Island. He is the author of several Aussie musical theatre works, also Razzmatazz, Shout and Dusty, the original pop diva, with David Mitchell and Mel Morrow, Pyjamas in Paradise with Peter Pinney, Dream Lover, the Bobby Darin story with Frank Hausen, and the play More Sex Please, We're Seniors. In 2025, his new musical, based on the lives of the Andrews sisters, will open in the USA. John Michael Hausen is a gifted raconteur with a million fascinating stories garnered from a lifetime enamored by and writing for and about the theatre, television and film. Well, you're used to a microphone.
Hey, pardon?
You're used to a microphone, aren't you?
I'm used to microphones. I'm used to lights and cameras and everything that goes with it.
Right. Yeah. Well, you're on.
Yeah. In fact, I tell you how used to microphones I am. I once appeared on 3KZ, which was a Melbourne station, on the children's hour. It went from 5 to 6 or 4 to 5 or something. And I went on and I sang. And this is back in 19... I think radio had just been invented. I'm not sure.
Anyway, the crystal
set. And it was, you know, you always had radio hosts that were called Auntie something and Uncle something. So I went on this radio show and sang, and the microphone didn't scare me one iota. So there you are.
So the camera, you've got to love the camera, don't you?
I was a bit terrified of cameras because I always thought they'd make my nose look too big or my... Look, I'd be squinting or something. I was very lucky. When I first went on camera, I was a bear in a bear suit in the Magic Circle Club, starting in about 1964, I think, something like that. And so when I went on camera, I was behind a mask. And I got very used to cameras because no one could see my face. Yeah. So by the time I took the mask off, and then I was a clown buying 10 tons of paint. I was the same. I was used to the camera. So when I became me, the cameras didn't worry me at all. I was quite used to it. When I went on shows like the early Mike Walsh show, the one in Melbourne before he went national, and then his show, and then Don's show, and then Bert's show, and you name it.
I remember Clown vividly growing up.
Clown was a character. Anthony Warlow does a wonderful clown, apparently, impression. So I've heard.
He's a great mimic, Warlow.
Yeah, yes, he does, and he does a great me as well, apparently. But I love the clown character was interesting because he didn't do any tricks. He couldn't juggle, couldn't do anything, but he'd just walk around forgetting things because his character was all based on... And you know why I put that in? Because I wrote the show as well. And I'd be writing dialogue and thought, oh, I'll never learn this. How am I going to learn this? So I had a little catchphrase. When I got dried, I'd say, I can't remember. And Liz Harris or... somebody would say, oh, yes, you can. You've got to say it. Give me the line.
You've got to have a catch cry, don't you?
Yeah. I can't remember. That was a clown thing. That got me out of a lot of trouble.
What came along first, Adventure Island or the Magic Circle?
Magic Circle. I'd been writing for a man in Melbourne. He went on to ABC Radio and a wonderful character, Ray Taylor. Have you ever heard of Ray Taylor?
I have, yeah.
Yes, Ray Taylor. Yeah. Well, Ray Taylor was given a Channel O, as it was called then, which is Channel 10 now, decided they would do a late-night Saturday talk show and a Ray Taylor show. And Ray was perfect for doing it. He was a urbane, sophisticated, nice-looking man, charming and very well educated. And he started doing this show when he'd have guests and the singer and whatever. But the problem was, only about three people in Melbourne could get Channel O. It was a disaster area. Anyway, the show only ran for about 25 weeks and was cancelled. But Ray, I don't know how this... Oh, I know. I went to Channel 10. I'd just come back from living in England. And Bolden's Brass turned up because I'd have a career of having written comedy sketches and things.
You wrote for David Frost, didn't you, in London?
I wrote some stuff for David Frost, yes, I did. And he, you know what thing about David Frost? He never forgot your name. I hadn't seen him for years. One day he goes, John Michael, how are you? And I was thrilled to bits. I thought he'd just said, I'm part of the scenery.
Yeah.
But he remembered people's names. Isn't that lovely? That's a gift, you know,
that
to do
gift,
that.
Isn't it, too?
Anyway... I went to Channel 10 and said, you need me, virtually, because I didn't have anybody. That I don't know what they signed up, something. So they gave me this job writing for Ray Taylor. And I love writing for Ray Taylor, except nobody saw the show, really. But he was a character, and as I said, taught me a lot. And then when that folded, Godfrey Phillip, who had been working at Channel 10, came up to me and they had a failing children's show that nobody looked at. And he said, we're going to do a new TV show. How would you like to work for children? And I said, for children? Me? He said, well, you've got a lot of sort of fantasy. A lot of the stuff you write is wonderful, fantastical stuff. So I said, I'll have a go. And then I went back and started thinking about what did I like when I was a kid. And I came up with all these stories and things about that I liked when I was a kid and developed the characters and the show became the Magic Circle Club and it was a huge hit. By this time, people were starting to watch Channel 10 and the trouble is with the management of 10 at that time, they didn't understand that you've got to be able to merchandise things. And they did. We could have had a huge merchandising catalogue, and the show was expensive to do. But for the first 6 months, we did it live to air, which was a little drama. I mean, live was very difficult to do. You had to rehearse the show and then go on air and do it, and then the next day the same thing. And then they invented videotape. So we didn't have to do that anymore. Well, that lasted about 3 years. And Liz Harris and, who else? Teddy Dunn and whoever, other cast members, were up in Brisbane doing our final sort of personal appearance, and we were cancelled. And on the way back to Melbourne, in what was called a Convair, that was the plane du jour, yeah, and we were flying back. And I'm sitting next to Liz, and I said, I've thought of another show. And I, by the time I got back to Melbourne, I'd written down notes of what it should be, and Godfrey Phillip took it to the ABC, brave man, went in the ABC. The ABC had a litany of disastrous shows that late afternoon time slot, and it was called, as I said, you know, the Adventure Island. And they said, yes, definitely. And that ran for 5 years. And it was only cancelled because certain bureaucrats at the ABC hated the fact that this was an independent company that was doing this show, that was raiding through the roof, selling kids' books, doing everything. It was just a huge hit. And the bureaucrats hated it.
Right.
And they undermined it, finally cancelled it. Now, the wonderful thing when they cancelled it, we had politicians' wives writing to the ABC, how dare you, my children live by this show. And but the ABC is, you know, it's a fortress. You can't, it didn't matter who complained. I think Tammy Fraser, you know, and the wife, Doug Anthony's wife, people all across Australia, every spectrum of Australian society, wrote in and said, you cannot cancel this show, but they did, and that was that.
It was the very early days of children's television also.
There was, the only children's shows you had, they were fine for their type of, you know, Princess Panda and Lucky Hammond and whatever, throwing things.
Happy Hammond, yeah.
Happy Hammond, yeah. Happy Hammond, and all those people do. They were fine in their thing. We did little dramas, you see.
Yeah.
Their shows was just like singing contests or Lucky Numbers. I can't remember, but they certainly we did and we employed a lot of actors. A lot of actors, you know, who weren't working at that time or in having a holiday. Would you like to do? Oh, I can't wait. So we had some very esteemed actors of the time coming in and doing guest roles.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was wonderful because I got to know a lot of wonderful people.
Have you still got a clown voice within you or a Fifi
Hello,
Bear?
Hello, everybody. I can't remember.
Yeah. I've got paintings over there. Look, over there on the wall. I can't see it at this angle. Of me. Yeah. I've got a few clown paintings around too.
Fantastic.
Yeah, what was happy days. We had look, you entertain children. You know, the thing that we never talked about was the fact that sometimes we didn't have a live audience, but they would bring in children who were not well and were on their last days, so to speak, and they were enamoured by the show and we were enamoured by them. Now, it was very, very hard emotionally dealing with that, I can tell you.
Yeah.
But Liz Harris, who always smoked, would put the cigarettes out, never smoked in front of the children. They were invalids, sometimes in wheelchairs, and, oh, you know, it was... I still could tear up.
Yeah.
The kids would go and we'd burst into tears.
Wow.
Because it was so sad.
Yeah.
So, so sad.
But what a wonderful thing you were doing for them.
It was... We were blessed.
Yeah.
It was a blessing. But I don't know who the... You know, we were blessed, and I, as you can see, I'm very emotional about it now because it was sad.
Yeah,
very
yeah.
sad. But wonderful for the soul.
Yeah.
Wonderful for the soul.
Yeah.
So I love that cast.
Yeah.
I love that cast.
A very special time in your career.
Yeah, oh, it was wonderful. I mean, we went to work every day happy. Every time we met up with each other, we were happy.
Yeah.
And that was marvellous to be in an atmosphere where you're always happy. The crew was happy.
Yeah.
I mean, we made friends with the crew. They wanted to work on the show because they get a lot of love. I mean, when we were rehearsing it, you rehearse some scenes and shoot it. The rehearsals sometimes could get out of control.
Yeah.
And they were very funny. You couldn't put it to wear what we did, but they were very funny. And then to have this, that with happy feeling, but then these wonderful little children coming in. And we gave what we could, and it still tears me up even now because I one little girl, you know, she couldn't move, she was at home, and we actually went to her home and did an episode of the show in her home.
Wow.
in her living room, and they're the darling little thing.
You must have been quite well read as a kid.
I lived on books.
Yeah.
I lived on
books. What are the books?
See, my grandfather, my mother's stepfather actually, was a journalist who, he wanted to be a lawyer. And the First World War came along and he couldn't do law anymore. And after the war, he became a journalist and wrote in country papers for the Argus. He wrote for the Argus in Melbourne. And because he had a law background and still read law books and whatever, he used to do all the top court reporting. And he encouraged me to read when I was four. And he would sit me on his knee and he would have the papers. And, of course, I'm dating myself. It was wartime news about the Blitz in London and God knows what. And he would say, now, what's that word there? And I was reading the papers. I mean, I didn't know what half of it meant, but I knew the words. And he encouraged me to read at a young age. Subsequently, when I went to school, I never did Bubs. I think I went straight into second grade. Because I was a fluent reader. Anyway, what a wonderful man he was. He was gassed in the war, World War One, and spent his whole life with the most terrible breathing problem. But still, you know, God knows he inspired. He got me into journalism, actually, because he was retired in Mildura. He'd been editor of the Sunraysia Daily, Mildura, many, many years before, then retired up there with my grandmother. And I came over from Western Australia and he said, do you want a job? I said, yes. He said, oh, look, I'll take you to the paper. You could do something there. Well, that lasted 3 years. I was supposed to come straight to Melbourne and do something down here, but I went straight into journalism. But in those days, you know, you learn journalism by doing things like the weather reporter, who won the local tennis match or whatever. Now they've got media schools. And I don't think they learn much except to be self-opinionated little shits. That's what they seem to be producing out of media schools. But when we were kids, we had to go and do hard reporting, starting off with the weather reports or the river levels or whatever, and you became you were out there, in my case, on a push bike, riding around Sunraysia, as the area's called, getting stories. That's where you learn, the hard grind.
You're serving an apprenticeship.
It's an apprenticeship. Yeah. And the money was lousy, the hours were lousy, yeah. But you loved the job.
Yeah.
And I work with wonderful characters. Funny enough, my editor was a man called George Tilly. And he would give me the rounds of the press room if I'd made... But that's good. You see, none of this. So you wouldn't be accused of bullying. Now he would be. He'd be, oh, he bullied me. No, he taught me the craft, as other journalists did. And what he said to me was, if you don't come back with a good story today, you're out of here tomorrow. Well, over the years, I kept in touch, and he came to when I was living in America. He and his wife turned up, and I was calling him Mr. Tilly and Mrs. Tilly. And he said, oh, stop that. I'm George and Melva. I said, Mr. Tilly, I could never call you George. I could not, to me, he was Mr. Tilly, and he would always be Mr. Tilly. And he's gone to God now, Melva and whatever. They taught you values, and they taught you hard work and discipline. And now everybody, these smart asses that, you know, have been media school, and they think they can conquer the world. I read stuff, I'm telling you, it annoys me. I read stuff in the local paper, in the daily press, written by media school graduates. And I look at reading, you don't know what you're talking about, you stupid idiot. You know, it's all my opinion. I didn't have an opinion until I was 30. You know,
yes.
That was it. You didn't have an opinion. Now that at 15, they've got an opinion, and we have to listen to it. Oh, the world's going to pot. Who's telling me? A 12-year-old. Yeah, forget it.
Yeah, yeah. Journalism has certainly taken a punch, hasn't it, since the disappearance of newspapers?
Yes, because it's all about stars, being a star, or having a byline. Yeah. You know, that's what it's all about. It's not about getting the news and writing a good story about the news, about what happens, being a star.
And you read a story online and the same thing is repeated about four times within the article that you read.
Exactly. Or telling, I mean, I read stuff that's factual nonsense. And you know what gets me is they've sent out handouts from these climate people and they just print the handout. Go to somebody that may not agree with that and get their opinion so you have both sides of the story. When do you see somebody like who's a sceptic, a climate sceptic like Ian Plimer being quoted? Never.
Yeah.
But if that fool, what's his name, Flannery, oh, it's gospel truth, the world's coming to an end. You know, they don't get contrary opinions.
Yeah, yeah.
It's too hard.
Yeah.
And I might upset somebody.
Perspectives. So was journalism always a vocation that you had in mind, or did you want to be an actor or something?
I didn't want to be an actor.
No.
I was scared of being an actor.
Right.
Getting up on the stage, having the spotlight, I couldn't do that.
Right.
Until I started to do it. But then I've never done really serious acting. I've only done the kids' shows and whatever. And I admire actors tremendously. How you remember all that? I have done a couple of plays. I actually toured Western Australia in My Fat Friend. Yeah, and the funny part, the producer hired the thinnest girl in the world to play the fat friend.
Right. That was a play that John Hinman had done, hadn't he?
I know. I love John. Yeah. I'll tell you a story about John. But first of all, I'll tell you about My Fat Friend. I don't know who the guy put it together, and he asked me and who else did it?
Robert Van Mecklenburg.
What was her name? The bomb bombshell that was on number 96.
Abigail
was playing the fat Fred. Well, she wasn't fat at all, but she was a little bit rotund, you know. And then Abigail decided she was going to do a picture. See, Abigail wanted to be a movie star, so she made god-awful movies to build her career. So she took off. And the understudy that they hired was the thinnest girl in the world. And even with a lot of padding, still looked like she had anorexia.
Right.
So here I was, oh, you've got to lose weight. And if she'd lost weight, she'd have faded away. And we're touring Western Australia up there. This is insane. I said to the producer, this is nuts. You've got to, this girl's so thin. She'd play My Fat Friend. Oh, God. You know, Robert Van Mecklenburg was in it with me. I can't remember who else. Anyway, it was a... we're very successful because you take a play to some of those places, they'll come from miles away just to have a night out somewhere. So we did okay, but it was hilarious with the thin girl playing the fat friend.
What's the John Inman story?
Well, John Inman, Derek Nimmo, who I knew quite well, called me up one day in London and said, did you know they're going to be doing an Australian version of Are You Being Served? I said, no. He said, well, they need someone to play the John Inman part. And I said, well, what are you calling me for? They said, well, you'd be perfect. I think only, you know, certain things about my background probably made them think that way. So they called me into the agent's office and whatever. It was very nice of Derek to do it. And they said, now, we're doing this thing and we would love you to do the John Inman part. I said, look, get John Inman. I said, I could do it, but everyone would be looking at the thing, well, he's not as good as John Inman. I said, and John's perfect. They said, oh, but he's asked too much money. I said, then pay it to him, because you've only got one John Inman. So get him and do it, which they did. So John came out here and did Are You Being Served? But he heard about my sacrifice and he called me up and he said, that was very nice of you to do that, dear. I said, well, you know, John, I'm only telling the truth. There's only one you and I couldn't have, you know, you didn't want to see her. You didn't want to see somebody pretending to be John Inman. So anyway, when he did come here, we teamed up and we became quite good friends. He was a lovely, lovely, lovely man. And he had a very pretentious boyfriend. That was a problem. An awful boyfriend. But he was himself was just lovely. And we became friends. And then, he passed away much too soon.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Perth earlier. Did you grow up in Perth?
I spent time in Perth because my mother's second marriage married a wonderful ex-cop who became a publican, who was a brilliant tap dancer. Now, that's something, isn't it? The yeah. tap dancing publican cop. And he used to, when he had a drink or two or three or four, he would get up on the bar counter and do a Fred Astaire. He was the best-looking bloke. He looked, he was so handsome, my stepfather. He was Daniel Beauparm Considine, good Irish background. And lovely man. And encouraged me to do, I was a pretty good runner. And he used to coach, I run a lot of schoolboy championships running. And now I'm just running away from people. I'm running to the finish line. But it was wonderful. And he was a dear man too. He liked a drink or two or three. But he would get up on the bar and tap dance brilliantly. It all started because when he was a kid, he had some leg problems. And the doctor said he should do exercise. And his mother wisely sent him to tap dancing school.
That was smart.
And, I mean, all this is back probably in the 20s. I don't know, way, way, way back. And he grew up being a and then became a cop, became a detective. And then he became a publican. And then he became a character. Yeah. And he was a character. I've been lucky. I have blood relatives who are Irish. I'm descended from Irish, English, Scottish, Scandinavian, you know. But the Irish thing played the bigger part. And my stepfather being Irish was great. Irish background, and his family were great, you know. So I've been surrounded by wonderful, but all of whom had the gift of the gab, all of whom could tell you a story and have you in stitches. So as a child, I remember seeing everybody laughing. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. Laughing and telling terrible lies to each other. You know, oh, profound liars are wonderful, but it didn't matter as long as the tag was good, you see.
Yes, you accepted this invitation pretty quickly to have a chat. You obviously enjoy a good chat.
Well, I was very flattered, Peter. I was very flattered because my friend David Sale had said you were wonderful to do. He loved doing it. And I thought, well, if David says that, I'll do it. And here I am. And I love it. I love chatting. And, you know, I'm now, quote, retired in the sense that I'm not performing on anywhere, but I don't mind that. You see, a lot of people can't give up. The sad thing is when you have people that have had their place in the sun and the spotlight and then keep on doing things that are beneath them simply because they can't bear being by themselves. Yeah. You know, you have to know when the light's going out. There's one chap I know who's had a very successful TV show. I'm not talking about Mike Walsh, because Mike is happily... If you point a camera at Mike now, he would run a mile, because he's so private in his life. I love him to death, too. We had a great working relationship and a great friendship. And but there's a chap that I know that keeps trying to revive a success that he had many years ago. And I wanted to say, don't do it. It's done. It was wonderful while it lasted, but you can't go back digging up roots. It's happened. Yeah, yeah. And it's a gift to be able to say, well, look, I've had a wonderful life. I can't remember my age. What am I going to do now? That's all a pathetic old thing up there. Yeah. Look, isn't it sad? And one of the things, they were at a charity concert.
Well, it's pretty impressive. It's several decades that you had.
90s to 9, my first, I was working as a journalist, but when I first started writing stuff for review theatre was 1956, and I'll tell you how that happened. I was at the ABC working in the newsroom, hated every minute of it. It was horrible. And next to me at the next desk was a bright-eyed young chap who was tapping away and smiling and laughing. I thought, he must be mental. He must be truly mental to be happy in this place. Anyway, I said, why are you always so happy? He said, oh, well, between news stories, I'm writing a show. Well, I'd never heard anyone say I'm writing a show except with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland movies. So I said, oh, you're writing a show? Where? He said, well, the St Martin's Theatre, I think it was called the Little Theatre in those days, do a Christmas review, and they've asked for some sketches and things for this So I said, that's marvellous. Can I come and see the show? He said, well, yeah, have you ever thought about writing something funny yourself? I said, oh, no, no. Now, that was beyond my comprehension that anybody could write anything, that, that I particularly would have the talent to write something like that. So I have a go. Now, television had just started. So I wrote a song called Television's Tough on Love, amongst other three or four other numbers. Well, they went into the show and they were hits. People laughed all the way through them. And this chap said to me, you've got a gift. And the chap's name was David Sale. And he went on to write Number 96 and produce the Mavis Bramson show. And we're still friends today. We can't lie to each other because we remember everything. I have another friend, John Muirhead, who was a working actor in England for years and years and years. Australian. We went to London together in 1960, and John stayed and became a working actor at the National Theatre and the Glasgow Public. Well, never a star, but he said stars have a lot of expenses. He was a working actor and got to know everybody in the business. In fact, people like Patsy Rowlidge and Judy Dench, and what did they still call him up? You know, how are you, love? He's the same age as me. And he lives in Caulfield now. He lived in England for years and years and years. But I can't tell any lies to him because he knows the truth. And so I can't tell any lies to David because he knows the truth. And that's great when you have friends that say,
They keep you honest.
I remember when you were doing... Oh, shut up. Catch amnesia, will you?
So you start writing for reviews around Melbourne for people like Mary Hardy and Joanne Whistler.
Mary Hardy, God bless her soul. There was a talent, a tragic... you know, Mary... She was Joan Rivers before there was Joan Rivers. Mm-hmm. She really was. But a tortured soul. I don't know what tortured her. I mean, John was a great... John Muir had been a great friend too. I would laugh. We would laugh ourselves. You know how I first met Mary?
No.
She was doing Peter Pan at the Princess Theatre. And I went to see it. Someone had told me about this amazing girl playing Peter Pan. So this would be 58, 7, 8, yeah, 9, I don't know.
It was a Garnet Carroll production.
Garnet Carroll tragedy. get in the gun. You know, you had things like scenery falling down. And I tell you, I just thinking about some of those reductions makes me laugh. Anyway, Mary's playing Peter Pan and she's whizzing around on the flying, you know, whirling around. I'm flying, whatever the song was. And the thing wouldn't stop. She's going around and around and around. There's all the little kids sitting there eating their ice creams and looking at Peter Pan, and suddenly through the theatre, get me off this fucking thing! And all the little children, what that mean, Mummy? Because now they'd know, they'd teach you. But in those days, that was a word no one ever said except Mary flying around the Princess Theatre.
And she was a great Agnes Gooch in MAME as well.
She was offered, this is another tragedy. She went to London and everyone who had by reputation, they'd heard about her Gooch, and the Gooch was leaving the London production with starring Ginger Rogers. And they offered Mary the part. And Mary was, oh God, this was going to be fantastic. You know, I'm going to be Gooch in a London production, and which she could have been the funniest thing ever. I think she was the funniest Gooch I've ever seen. Anyway, Ginger, best known to her, said, no, I don't want to do it anymore. And they closed the show.
Oh.
And I think it broke Mary's heart in a way. Mm. Because, and you know the thing that happened to Mary? Mary was a very talented actress. But acting means you have to sit down and learn lines and you have to turn up to rehearsals and you have to work hard. And Mary was suddenly offered to a breakfast rate where they were paying her more money than she'd ever seen in her life. And she said, this is great. All I have to do is get up early, go in there, which itself was a trial for Mary, getting up early, go in there and talk, be me. And she was seduced by that. Because she wouldn't go back to the theatre. I said, Mary, that you're gifted, please. Why don't you come to London with us and we'll... And she didn't. She stayed because she was making, you know, whatever it was they paid her. But it was more money than she'd ever seen. And that seduced her away from her real talent, which was acting. And you know, at the time, there was an actress called Rita Tushingham. Remember Rita Tushingham?
No, I don't. An Australian actress,
was in Dr. Zhivago and a lot of plays in London, A Taste of Honey. And Mary was another Rita Tushingham. That type, that Gaman type, would have worked for her if she'd have stayed in the theatre. She was a tragedy. And because you know what, she, one of her things that she used to do, she'd go to America and go to the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hilton Hotel just to look at movie stars. She'd sit there every day looking at movie stars coming in and out. And, you know, she was obsessed by all that. I loved her dearly. She could be a trial, you know, but friendship comes with in many colours, and sometimes being a friend, it can be difficult. And she could make life difficult. But I loved her, and she was talented and forgotten by everybody now, unfortunately. It's like Frank Thring, another great talent. I saw Frank Thring's one-man show, which is probably one of the great one-man shows. He did it at the Melbourne Theatre Company. You know, nobody ever taped it. It's forgotten by everybody, and yet was one of the great one, as you could imagine.
Frankly Thring, I think, at the Russell Street.
Russell Street Theatre. And it was hilarious. It was absolutely wonderful. Frank, I knew Frank for years. He used to call me Pixie.
Pixie.
How are you, Pixie? And you know, I think he did that. He's supposed to be, he's alert, you would be terrified of him. But he was a cuddly teddy bear, really. He just had this wonderful look and persona, and he never stopped acting. Even when he was walking down the street, he was doing a role. But, Pixie, come over here and talk to your Uncle Frank.
So writing all those reviews, did you eventually have an opportunity to write for television?
Write for television? Yes, that's how I got the Ray Taylor. I went to England and I wrote stuff for people over in England.
Did you do Mavis Brampton here or anything like that?
Yeah, what happened with Mavis Brampton? Oh, God. Well, just digressing a bit. In England, I was working as a journalist from fashion magazine, believe it or not. Talk about champagne life and a beer income. Oh, they flew me to Milan and Rome and everywhere to cover fashion shows. I thought, this is hell. Life, staying in under, I didn't have any money, but I had this wonderful expense account and all this high living. So, and I got to know a lot of the top fashion designers of the time. My favourite, if you wanted to know, was Hardy Amies. And oh, what a... Oh, God, talk about, you should have been a film star. It's wonderful. Anyway, and then I came back and got into review writing. Oh, and while I was doing all that in England, I would sell lines to comics, like I did with David Frost. That was the week that was, and other things. They'd write, they'd pay a pound or something.
A joke.
For a joke. And I wrote for the dirtiest comic I've ever seen, forgotten by everybody. A Jewish chap called Ray Martin, who worked at the Hackney Wick Hotel and was filthy. And then someone gave him a television show and only lasted about a week because he was so filthy. But, oh, he was wonderful. And I wrote to him, and he was wonderful. Gay as a room full of pixies, I've got to tell you. And I tell you, he used to hang out at the pub, the Cray brothers.
Oh, Reggie and
yeah,
Rob.
Well, Reggie looked at me one night. You've never seen one run so fast as I did. I said, who's that chap staring at me? And they said, it's Reggie Cray. Oh, God, out of here. Gone. Anyway, as I said, I sold on, came back, got it. And then David was producing... Mavis Bramston. So he said, you want to write some stuff for Mavis Bramston? So I wrote some stuff for Mavis Bramston. And then one day I came up with an idea for a theatre. It's hard to explain. It was when they were censoring everything. Remember they used to censor books and censor movies and censoring. What a terrible word. Anyway, I came up with the idea that these people that censor everything see filth in everything when there's no filth intended. But they're so obsessed with sex themselves that they see filth in everything. So I got a chap who was a censor coming home and his wife's reading the Woman's Weekly. And he said, "What are you reading that?" And she says, "I'm really looking at the flower arrangements." And he said, "What? Well, let me look at it. Look, filth, filth." And I literally took a flower arrangement out of Constance Spry's flower arrangement book. Now, Constance Spry was famous for wonderful flower arrangements and whatever. So I wrote thing, well, you take the stem and then you nip off the end. And, well, I mean, I can't remember. It all alluded to sex. But it was actually the true flower arrangement. It wasn't me making the flower arrangement up. It was the flower arrangement. So the sketch goes to air with Chuckles Chaita playing the censor, the censor of the husband, and of course dear Carol Ray playing the wife. And he said, "Look at this filth, there's every page of it. Darling, it's the Woman's Weekly. I don't care, these things come in all shapes and sizes." Anyway, the sketch goes to air. Oh, apparently people called up and said, "See, prove my point." It was an actual flower arrangement, and they were seeing it was filthy, thinking that stem meant a penis or whatever. Right.
And you take the stalk and you place it gently.
Put it at whatever. And then, but the funniest one, the bishop of somebody said, Ampol was the sponsor. "I'm cancelling my shares in Ampol." I said, "Well, number one, very interesting the bishop has shares in Ampol. I thought you were sworn to poverty." And secondly, he saw the filth where there was no filth there. Well, I was on the... I had an aunt, my godmother, used to say to me, "If you're not careful, dear, one day you'll finish up on the cover of Truth." Now, Truth was a scandal paper, you see. Yes. "You'll finish up on the cover of Truth if you're not careful." Well, the next thing, I'm on the cover of Truth. Filth and accusations, Mavis Bramston, whatever. And I had the great joy of ringing up and said, "Auntie Margaret, I'm on the cover of Truth." But it was a conversation piece for they were talking about it on radio. It wasn't all dreadful. And I said, "A great pleasure," saying, "I didn't do anything, I just put in a flower arrangement. It's all your problem, you see, the filth in it." There was no filth, it was a genuine flower arrangement.
Yeah.
But it was a sensation for a couple of weeks at least.
Yeah. I love the pantos, Christmas pantos you did on the Mike Walsh show every year. You wrote those, didn't you?
No, Bill Wallace wrote them. Right. I helped him, but mostly it was Bill. Bill Wallace was a producer on the... A lovely English chap, still going, 89. I speak to Bill regularly. And see, that's the sort of friendship that we made on that show. Lifelong friendships. And Bill used to have a typical English sense of the panto. And came up with the idea of maybe we should do a Christmas panto every year. And of course, me being the resident camp on the show, I had to play Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. I played Snow White.
You were the principal. Off,
they called me Off White.
The principal girl.
I was the principal girl in everyone. And Jimmy Hannon was the Wicked Queen in Snow White. I remember that. And Mike Williams was Robin Hood. Mike Walsh always had a feature because he couldn't learn all the lines. So he'd come on and say something. "Oh, Mike's in a frock." Or, no, we never got in a frock. "Mike's in tights." And that would be the joke. "Mike's in tights." Anyway, people used to call and say, "Why don't you put this thing on at night? It's so funny. Put the show on at night." Because it ran for the whole length of the... So yes. It was like an hour and a half long. And Channel 9, in their wisdom, never did. But I'm sure it would have rated its socks off at night. But we had Off-White and the seven Wharfies. So we couldn't get dwarves, so we got Wharfie, though. Oh, and we did... I can't remember all of them. Cinder Boots, which was a... combination of Puss in Boots and Cinderella, and it was just every year. And you know, people used to ring up. This is amazing. The show had gone to air live, and literally after it, the phones were, can I book for next year? People wanting to book into the show a year hence.
And see it live.
Yeah, to see, be in the studio, to right. see it done. And isn't that wonderful? But they were a funny crowd of people. I mean, Jan Adele, my darling Jeannie Little, oh my God, bless her. And all those wonderfully funny...
Lucky Grills.
Yeah. People that were just marvellous to be... Johnny Lockwood, yeah. just marvellous to be with. You're just marvellous to be with.
They're characters that you don't see a lot of nowadays.
No. I look at, you know, have a look at television, if you want to. I mean, I'm addicted to detective shows. I love, I'd be a wonderful cop. I'd be like my stepfather, because I solve the crime before it's even committed. But you look at these, Married at First Sight, The Bachelor, The Housewives of wherever, Yackalander. I mean... You look at this crap and you think, do people actually watch this?
Yeah.
And it's all, and the vilest people in the world on it. I don't know whether they think they're wonderful stars or they're illuminating people's lives. I just look at them and think, you're bloody pathetic. Yeah. These overmen made up cookie cutter women all look the bloody same. These poor men that are so desperate to get their mushes on TV, they'll do anything. I just think it's like looking at a lineup of prostitutes.
Yeah.
It's like driving down, you know, some street with lined with tarts and saying, oh, this is wonderfully entertaining. No, it's crap. Just call it crap for what it is. It's cheap crap that absolutely... Man, the farmer's looking for a wife. Well, most of the farmers look terribly gay to me. I don't think he'll do. Look at me, you're looking for a boyfriend.
Yeah, we have to go to the streaming services, don't we, to find intelligent television.
Absolutely, absolutely. I love watching Scandi Noir, you know, German. I watch it doesn't matter where it comes from the world, as long as it grips you.
Yeah.
As long as you're within the first 5-10 minutes, you say, great TV.
Yeah, yeah.
You can tell, you know.
Yeah.
You can just tell. And you can see the difference in writing now. I think they've been dumbing down so much of American television, dumbing it down. And so when you look at European or Australia, even now we're doing great stuff here, non-North American TV... It's like it's been written by Shakespeare, because there's so much depth to it.
Yeah.
Even the slockiest of shows have wonderful writers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, looking at... My friend is addicted to NCIS. Well, it's my idea of doing penance. If the priest says, say, 5 Our Fathers and 10 Our Marys, I come home and watch NCIS. I've done the same thing, because it's penance. You just look at the characters are so woeful and shallow. And that's sad because American television used to be great. They turned out, when you think of the great Norman Lear shows,
yeah.
and even Larry David now and Seinfeld. God almighty.
We look at your career as a journalist. The Mike Walsh Show afforded you an opportunity to become, I would say, Australia's first entertainment reporter.
Well, I probably was.
Yeah.
And that all happened because in 1976, the Mike Walsh Show sent me to America because it was the 200th anniversary of the USA, right? 1976. And I said, do some stories about celebrating. I can't remember what the miss was, but that's it. So I go over there and I... teamed up with a lady, she was married to Marlene Daly, who actually was working with Channel 7 in LA. She was married to Jonathan Daly. Remember Dino and Daly? Probably people out there. They were two American comics that came to Australia and did a TV show on Channel 7 and then went back to Oblivion. But Marlene lined up interviews for me. So suddenly I'm talking to Charlie's Angels. Etc., etc., all these stars. She's getting me in everywhere. So I came back. Oh, and I remember they sent somebody, a very high-powered interviewer from one of the stations over, and came back with nobody. I was thrilled about that. And I came back with cans of interviews with all these stars. So I thought, this is fun. See, one thing I learned very quickly. First of all, the star is often more terrified of being interviewed than the interviewee. I mean, more terrified of being the interviewee than the interviewer. And also, a lot of stars have done something that's failed, but they loved. So I got busy thinking about people that had done a film that hadn't worked, but they personally liked. And I'd say, you know, Mr. Hoffman, or whoever. I loved a film you did called Whatever. They said, did you? Oh, I thought it was wonderful. I never understood why it didn't do any good at the box office. He said, it's the publicity department. There's always somebody else. The publicity department, they didn't know how to sell it, or the whatever, whatever. The marketing was terrible. But it opens the door. Once they see you're sympathetic to them and you're not looking at a clipboard, which a lot of people, you know, it's like chained to them. The clipboard, I hate clipboard interviews. Learn your stuff. Learn all the questions, think about all the questions you want to ask and ask them. But when you go in there with a piece of paper, with it, you know, you say, what's that to do with anything? Just talk, look in their eyes, yeah, for God's sake. Yeah, yeah. Communicate.
That's great. How am I doing? Because I've been referring to the odd piece of paper. Oh, yeah,
no, you haven't. You've just got some notes. No, but that but no, you know what I mean. You've seen them.
Well, I their feel eyes, like I'm,
that's yeah. what I loved about Parkey.
Yeah.
Parkey never looked at a bloody clipboard. Mm-hmm. And it's a bane to me that you've got to stare at notes before you ask them a question. If you forget the question, it doesn't matter. I mean, I've interviewed people from the youngest to the oldest. I had a wonderful interview with, believe it or not, Ethel Merman, with David Mitchell, was my producer. And then David does a wonderful impersonation of Ethel Merman. I got a dream. And I said to David, you know, when we're going to interview Miss Merman, I might just tell her that you do a wonderful impression of her. Well, David, he almost turned to stone. The blood drained from his face. He said, no, don't do that. I said, David, it'd be marvellous. Maybe you could do a duet together. I can't tell you, he was trembling when we went into the interview. So, hello, boys. She wasn't quiet, Ethan. She wasn't a demure little lady, I can tell you. Told the filthiest jokes I've ever heard. Anyway, in the course of the interview, I said, you know, Miss Mitchell, my producer over there, David, and David frankly fell against the wall. I thought he died. And I said, she said, what about him? I said, he's got every record, every album you've ever made. I have you, honey, that's wonderful. By that time, the blood started to come back into his face. But I can't tell you how wonderful she was. Betty Davis was wonderful. I've got a couple of things on my wall. They have candlesticks, things, candelabra from Betty Davis's house. In my idol. Oh, she was wonderful. And many, many, many ageing stars who'd passed their prime but still had great stories to tell.
Yeah.
That was, and I befriended. Do you know what was lovely? Sometimes people would say, as Ethel did when we finished the interview, what are you boys doing now? I said, well Miss Merman, we're going home, we'll have lunch. You're coming to lunch with me. She took us to lunch. And she said, her mind has stood up to go with her. And she said, sit down, I didn't ask you. The mind has backed into the wall. And Dave and myself went on and had lunch with Ethel Merman.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was wonderful.
You're very right. It's all about the research, isn't it? If you know your subject.
Exactly.
They will be impressed and come along and with you. And exactly. The other thing, listening, being a good listener.
Listen to what they've said.
Yeah.
Do you know, I used to say that about a dear friend of mine. He's dead now, but he was a dear friend of mine. Don Lane,
yeah.
Who I liked a lot. But Don never listened to people. They would say something and he would just go on to the next question. And think, but they've just given you the opening to a fabulous story.
Investigate.
But
that
he
a bit
didn't
more.
Listen. Mm. They just, it's so, I think it's nerves. I really think with Don it was nerves. He'd have some huge star sitting next to him. And instead of saying, well, having said that, I want to ask you this. He would go, and what was it like at the taxi ride coming here? I mean, there'd be some facile question that didn't get anywhere.
Yeah.
And that you've got to listen to people. You're having a conversation with them. And you know, I was a bloody good interviewer. And I always thought it would have been nice to have a bit of an interview show. Would have liked to have done that. but it didn't happen because, you see, everybody saw me as sort of somebody like a ventriloquist dummy sitting on somebody's knee. You know, I had a position to be, I was there to be funny for 20 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever and then go home, but nothing more than that. So I don't have any regrets. I made a good living and had a nice
life. But that would have been lovely.
But I would have loved to, but particularly with stars.
Like yeah.
Because, you know, there's a lot of people, they do, you ask, I found out so many times talking to really great stars, I would ask a question and they'd never been asked it before and they would open up and tell you, and that it like was opening the keys of the kingdom. They'd suddenly say, oh God, he knows us. And they'd be very forthcoming on something that wasn't scheduled in the interview, they didn't think they'd ever been asked that.
Mm-hmm. What was the toughest interview you had to do?
The toughest interview? Yeah. Well, somebody I couldn't stand, thought he was horrible, Tommy Lee Jones, and he is horrible. And Meg Ryan, who also screwed up on Parky's show. Yeah, yeah. She's a bitch.
Yeah.
So there you go. But they were the two.
Just because they were difficult to talk to or didn't want to be
they're
there?
They're just horrible people.
Right.
And also, I'm thinking about, just went through my head. Oh, Robert De Niro, who is the dullest man that ever drew breath. I was like interviewing myself because I'd ask him a question and almost have to give the answer because he'd just say, oh, yeah, yeah. And then you did, you know, what's his name? Deer Hunter or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
I did.
a nightmare. I thought, when is this frigging thing going to end? It was a torture.
What about your favourite interview?
My favourite, oh, I have thousands of them. Yeah, Dustin Hoffman.
It's a bit hard, isn't it?
Debbie Reynolds, we became good friends. I love Debbie. Debbie took me right through her wardrobe. You know, she collected costumes. She went and bought stuff from MGM when they were selling it up, and she had an old post office in an area of Los Angeles called Van Nuys, and she had all these costumes in there. And you also had rehearsal rooms as well. But she had one area with all costumes from great Hollywood movies, great MGM movies. And she had seamstresses preparing them. And her ambition was to open a huge Hollywood costume museum. And she had one that wasn't very big for a while. And then she had another one, I think, in Las Vegas. But nothing like she wanted to have. But she was a sweetheart. She was a very eccentric lady, brilliantly talented. Her cabaret act was sensational, but quite eccentric. And I loved that about her. She wasn't like a run-of-the-mill movie. So when I was in 1945, it doesn't, nothing like that. Just, and I tell you, I loved Esther Williams. I had lunch with Esther a couple of times. I have a story about, I don't know whether I can tell this story about Esther. Well, Esther had written her book, and I said to her, the one where she said that movie star was dressed, what was his name, Jeff Chandler, used to get into frocks, and he turned up one night wearing a polka dot dress, and she said, darling, you're too big to wear in polka dots. And oh God, she was wonderful. She was a bawdy lady. She gave it up because she was married to Fernando Lamaze, and she stayed home and brought up his kid, you know, Lorenzo, and her kids or whatever. And she said, I said, why'd you give up? She said, because Lorenzo's an Argentine Latin and he didn't believe in his wife working, so I stopped working. And she said, besides, honey, they once said about me, wet I'm a star, dry I'm not. And she's pretty true. I'm great in the pool, and I wasn't too good on the acting chops. So she was lovely and honest about herself and told wonderful stories about people putting hard word on her in the pool and whatever. Anyway, she got married to this bloke and she said, I don't know why I married him. I'm trying to remember. I'm writing my memoirs. Why did I marry him? We didn't have much in common. And then suddenly dawned on me. I said, what was that, darling? She said, he had a great big... Well, coming out of Esther Williams, that floored me, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But they would, oh God, I can't say in hundreds of interviews, but As I said, I only met two people I didn't like.
What was Streisand like?
Actually, very nice to me.
Yeah.
We did the first interview I did with her was at her estate, which was like in Malibu, where she had an open air sort of amphitheatre. And that's where she did the thing with Barry Gibb to an invited friendly audience. She had that, remember that yep. thing? She did it in her own
right, in the backyard.
Now, she had about five houses on this estate, all built in different architectural styles. She had like a Swiss cottage and an Art Deco place and what they called Southwestern, you know, Santa Fe style. In this beautiful garden, all these different houses and a stream running through the place. Part of it, the stream was walled off a swimming pool. And
she's got a shopping mall underneath as well, hasn't she?
No.
It's a different place.
No, dude. I did ask her, I said, what happens when you go shopping? So I got around, do you ever go intimidated by shopping, going out? She said, no. She said, if I go to the mall, people come and say, hello, are you Barbara Streisand? She said, no, I just look like her. I said, what happened? They leave me alone. But we finished up, which was very nice, sitting on the floor of the Santa Fe house, drinking some bottles of wine and talking about our mothers and our families and everything. You know what I found with her? I think she had built up a wall around her where she was so suspicious of being exploited that she just became like not a recluse, but she was very nervous of meeting people. So once we settled into the interview, she was lovely and started talking about ordinary things. She was wonderful. And I was supposed to do like, you know, 20 minutes. I finished up sitting there for about 2 hours. And then we opened the wine and we chatting. Now, the next interview I did with her was when she did that film where she's supposed to be mad. I can't remember it.
Nuts.
You know, with Richard Dreyfuss, I think.
It was called Nuts, wasn't it?
What was it called?
Nuts.
Yeah. And we did that, and she was lovely again. But I think it was she was intimidated by the press, because one of the things she said, if the press don't know anything, the truth, they'll print a wonderful lie. And she said, then you've got your coat with the situation of trying to defend yourself about something you haven't done, which I think is more happening today. Right. You know, people have only got a burp and suddenly it's headlines that they've done this, that and the other thing and they're horrible. And then you've got to say, well, I didn't do that. Well, how can I tell people I didn't? You can't, because once the lie is out there, it's out there, and you can't do anything about it.
How many times did you attend the Oscars?
23 times.
23, wow. 20. And you were attending them when they were the golden years, weren't they?
Now, I look at the Oscars now, I hardly look worth looking at now. First of all, the people comparing them, you know, Jimmy Kimmel, give me a break, you know. Now, when you had Billy Crystal and people like that, marvellous. But I remember when they had the Oscars and they did the wonderful big production numbers and they opened with 100 dancers and fabulous sets and, oh, I mean, it was Hollywood. It was what you wanted from Hollywood. Now it's like a revival meeting and everyone gets up and, I hate Donald Trump. Well, yes, darling, everybody's supposed to have. I think they didn't have Donald Trump. They have no life.
Right.
They've made Donald Trump the centre of their lives. I watch CNN and CBS, or whatever it was called, MSNBC, sometimes if I really want to torture myself. And all they do is Donald Trump, shut up. I mean, you're giving him publicity every time you say
exactly.
Every time you mention his name, he's winning more votes.
Yeah.
But they're so thick, they don't know it.
Really.
And as I said, instead of being wanting to report the news, they want to report their opinions, which, you know, is devastating. So the Oscars I went to, the fabulous, the best one I went to, and I almost cried, was when they did the tribute to the MGM stars. And every living MGM star was up on that stage, the singers and the dancers.
Yeah, you can see it on YouTube. It's terrific.
It was wonderful. Yeah. I grew up on the MGM. That was my escape
valve. Esther Williams shoots up out of the floor.
That's right. Yeah. When I was a kid, the MGM musicals were my escape hatch. When the curtain went up and the MGM line came on and then the singing and the dance, I was there. I was there, up there. So it was like Tony LaMond and myself have talked about that when she lived in Hollywood and I was there at the same. The magic of just going down the street and saying, I remember that from that movie and whatever. Because we were, it's like Carol Burnett, I love Carol Burnett. And we shared, we talked, I said, you know, you were a, because, you know, Carol grew up in sort of not wealthy circumstances, living in Hollywood, in Yucca Street, Hollywood. And her escape was with her grandmother going to picture, because there's 100 movie theatres in that area, if there was, and going to the pictures every day and believing at all that was it outside her door. And we talked about that, that escape hatch you had the moment you walked into the wonderful cinemas, the picture palaces, and you then transported to the MGM musical stage. It was my escape hatch. And that's probably why I grew up as nutty as I am. But it was wonderful. And that that number of them all dancing, all those people that were still alive up on that stage, brought tears to my eyes. I thought, this is my childhood up there. Yeah. This is my fantasy land that I live. They're all up there in front of me.
Were you able to go into the auditorium and watch?
Oh, I was always in the auditorium.
Right, great.
Yeah, and then I had a pass to go back to the interview rooms afterwards. I mean, what used to happen was Channel 9 used to, there's always people sell their seats. They, you know, then you're not allowed to do it now. They have all checks and balances. But in those days, Channel 9, Channel 9 Australia had offices, they still have offices in LA. So they'd assign me to go to the Oscars and then go and buy a black market ticket. So I always had a ticket in the auditorium. And I remember, this is an awful, one year I got tickets that had belonged to Ray Milland. And he died a few days before. And I said, well, poor old Ray, I'm sorry he's gone. But lucky old me, I got his seat. Oh, God. Anyway, it was wonderful. And you're just being, you see, the thing people forget about the Oscars, or don't know about the Oscars, the people that go to the Oscars, apart from the general, the people that are backroom people, whatever, but the stars that go there are usually because they're going to be presenters or they're nominees. Not, you just don't say, oh, I think I'll go to the Oscars on Monday night. They don't do that. They just, they're not there at their home watching it on television and laughing and picking, he shouldn't have won. I've been to one of those parties. After I stopped going to the Oscars, I actually was invited to a party at a celebrity's house, and I've never heard such bitchy talk in my life. Anyway, it was an adventure to be walking up the red carpet and you know, be your, and I used to take a crew down in the morning of the Oscars and do interviews with people who were already sitting in the bleachers, the fans that have come from near and far and were sitting in the bleachers waiting for the stars to arrive. And they were one, and they got to know me because I did it year after year. And people said, they'd be there. Hello, how are you, Ken? We haven't seen you since last year. It was wonderful. And then at night turning up dressed as the nines. And one year, what I used to do was the red carpet interview thing. But the secret is you've got to get stars to look at you because they're besieged by hundreds of journalists. So what I used to do was wear coloured tuxedos, pink or green or something, you know, fabulous, something jewelled bow ties. I looked like a circus clown. And after I'd done that, I took them all off and got into something decent. But they would look at me and think, what the hell's that? And then they'd come walk in my direction. And other people, and you know, well, I can't think of his name. It was a famous interviewer, and he said to me, we're American, he said to me, why do they all come to you? I said, just look at me. Look at me. They think they're talking to Bozo the Clown. But I got interviews. And then when we did the reverse shots, I would take all this paraphernalia off and just get in, change my jacket and tie. And so I looked like I was a normal person. I'd have the crew holding my black dinner jacket and proper bow tie or whatever. But I wore all these colours and I was very flattered because having worn a pink suit one year and interviewing Steve Martin, the very next year he turned up in a pink suit. And I thought, I think I know what inspired you, Steve.
You're a trendsetter.
But that's a jungle. That red carpet's a jungle with people fighting and screaming for somebody to talk to them. It's a jungle. But it's wonderful, you know, because if it's quite, you know, particularly with nominees who don't know whether they've won or they're going to win or what, and the excitement you feel from them, wonderful.
Yeah.
And I did wear the, oh, the Shrine Auditorium, the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, wherever, I think I did the Pantages one. No, I did those. But anyway, all the various venues that, where they had it when I was in Los Angeles. Or before I went to Los Angeles, actually, I used to go over and do it. LA's quite a place. Yeah. Not anymore, it's turned into the dregs now. Yeah. But it was great.
When did you start writing for the musical theatre? Was that Razzmatazz?
Oh, you know about Razzmatazz.
Yeah.
Yes, I wrote a show in the 1970s. And it was Cinderella set in a brothel.
I'm trying to get my head around that.
Well, what it was, Melbourne Bourke Street, Little Bourke Street, was notorious in the 1880s and 1920s or whatever as being full of gin joints and brothels. And one of there's a great story. One of them was owned by a woman called Madame Brussels. And the Speaker of the House of Parliament in Victoria once took the mace into the, I don't know what he was going to do with the mace in a brothel. I shudder to think. But he took him into the thing and lost it. And they lost the mace. It was stolen out of the brothel. Oh, great scam, Melbourne scandal. Anyway, I came up with an idea of doing this sort of 1920s set musical where the Cinderella's father, his girlfriend's Madam whatever, and he dies and leaves the Cynthia, as she's called, all his money. Well, the madam is keen to get all the money. So she's got the moles are like her daughters. So it was set in. It was all jazz music and whatever. And a wonderful lady called Little, well, she's now grandmother, but she was only like a teenager at the time, Hilary Henshaw, who's made a career daughter entertaining at afternoon teas and old folks' homes, and what a lovely Jewish girl. And she is just the sweetest thing in the world. She was perfect for playing this little innocent girl sucked into this vice. John Finlayson played, it's not the prince, but the ponce. And, Bert Cooper. I can't remember all the cast. The girls were... they're all talented anyway, and we did it at theatres. They had a theatre, it was all been rebuilt now, but they had a theatre at the Southland Shopping Centre, and we did it there. And it ran for God knows how long. And Ken Brodziak was talking about picking it up to do a commercial production, but that never happened. And I think it would have been a big hit at the time. But it was great. I'm trying to think of myself. Once I get on the thing, I can't think of all the names. But it was a big hit, and that inspired me. I love the whole idea of musicals. I love musicals. My first musicals were actually pantomimes back in the 1940s when I used to see Jim Gerald as the Dame and Jenny Howard as the principal boy. I mean, that's taking you back, honey.
And you were, I believe, at the first preview of Hello, Dolly on Broadway.
I was walking down the street in 1964, it was, and there was a thing out the front of a theatre saying, "Preview tonight, Hello Dolly, half price tickets." I thought, well, I'm not going anywhere, I'll go into this, I'll see this, I don't know, don't know anything about it. So I went in, paid, that Broadway tickets then were so cheap. Now you've got to mortgage your house to go to a Broadway show. And, you know, I used to take people to Broadway. And now I say, I can't afford to take you there anymore. You know, $300, $400 a ticket. Give me a break. Anyway, I paid whatever it was, you know, $20 or $10 or something. Went in, knew nothing about the show. Then saw it was based on The Matchmaker. Thought, oh, that'll be interesting. And it opens up, and there's Carol Channing and... oh, what was the name? Again, I'm getting the name, but you know, the cast, the original cast. Hello, darling. And I'm thinking, this show's amazing. Because Jerry Herman, I didn't know anything about Jerry Herman. This show is amazing. These songs you can't remember, can't forget. I went back to where I was staying. I said to my friends, I've just seen a show. It's going to be the biggest hit of all time. And I said, listen, he's been in New York 10 minutes and he knows what's going to be a hit. They all laughed at me. I said, I'm telling you. I said, it's filled with wonderful songs, but there's one song that everybody will be singing. Was I right or was I wrong?
You're absolutely right.
And I got to meet Jerry Herman and told him that story. And Jerry was the sweetest little man, you know. He was a lovely little man. And Carol, I told Carol as well. And she finished up quite nutty, but I loved her. She used to bring her own food to dinner parties, you know. Oh. She's a health nut. Right. And she didn't trust eating anybody else's food. So you invited to dinner, you didn't have to do any cooking because Carol would come with little packages and tell me, this is what I'm going to eat. And aren't they wonderful?
Great
Don't
characters.
You love people I like
love
that?
I love them.
And in fact, John Frosty organised my interviews with Jerry Herman. And then I met him a few times after that. I was and you know what I loved about Jerry? When Rent was a hit. Now, Rent's a great show. But the reviewers came out and said, oh, Rent is Broadway's new way. It's got no more of these glitzy musicals. It's going to be down and truthful in the gutter. It's going to be... I thought, no, it's not. It's self-torture, see the show. One show's enough, put it that way.
Yes.
Anyway... Jerry Herman, when he won an award for something, I said, there's been a rumour going around that the show tune is dead. I don't think so. And it's true, because after Rent, it all went back to being... Although I'm still looking for a show that will be like Hello, Dolly, or like MAME, or like whatever.
La Cage aux Folles.
La Cage aux Folles, yeah. Yes.
Now, where did you get the idea for Shout?
Well, I remember, you see, I was a teenager when Johnny O'Keefe was the king of the rock and roll. I mean, rock and roll was new. It was still Bill Haley and the Comets. I remember I was born before they were on the scene. Anyway, Johnny O'Keefe used to come to do his... I was always there screaming like we all did. But what we loved about Johnny O'Keefe, remember, this is the... time where we really didn't have any stars here in the sense of what we have now, and they'd import everybody. So you go along to Festival Hall to see American pop stars and say, oh, they've blessed us with their presence. Isn't it wonderful? They've come all this way to Australia. They were being paid mega bucks, I might add. And Johnny...
people like Johnny Ray, I suppose.
I love Johnny Ray. I met Johnny Ray.
Yeah, yeah.
Sad man.
Was he?
Anyway, you'd go along. Well, he was a star. I mean, he did pack him in because... oh, bye. Say goodbye. Anyway, but when we saw Johnny O'Keefe, we knew he wasn't going to get on a plane and go home. He was here. He was one of ours. And then when the television, you had Bandstand and whatever, Bandwagon, I can't remember, where you actually built Australian pop stars, Little Patty and all those.
Olivia, Peter Allen.
Olivia, well, I knew Olivia when she was a schoolgirl. Oh. She used to come to Channel 10 to do the Go Show in a school uniform and then get changed into a miniskirt and a blonde wig and whatever. She was the most beautiful girl I've ever seen in my life. And I said to them in the canteen one day at Channel 10, that girl's going to be the biggest star you can imagine. They said, why? I said, well, not only can she sing, not badly, she's a pretty good singer, but have a look at her. I said, she's gorgeous. Yeah. And she was gorgeous. And a nice girl.
That's good to hear.
A lovely, nice girl.
Yeah.
And that makes you feel good about people, doesn't it? And lived a wonderful life and died bravely. I just think she was super. Like Kylie. I met Kylie when she was a kid doing that thing with Jason, Neighbours. And you know what's lovely? Now, we only met briefly a couple of times when she was going out with Jason Donovan. Every time I've seen Kylie since, she's come up and given me a little kiss.
Oh.
and remembers me.
That's
and
nice.
I think, God, with your career, with phenomenal career that she's had, and she still remembers. See, that's a graciousness about that. You can't pretend. You're born with that.
That's a star.
Yeah, that's a star. Yeah, you remember names and who you were and who, oh, that person, oh, that so-and-so. That's wonderful. She, so what were we talking about?
Shout.
So I got the idea I used to go and see Johnny, but he belonged to us. He didn't get on a plane and go home. And now he was a troubled soul. No one will ever deny Johnny was not a troubled soul, but he was magic on that stage. And you know how much he loved entertaining, and which we've got in the show, which is still being performed by amateur theatres all around Australia. What was wonderful, he would get in front of four people in a country pub and perform, because he just wanted to perform. I mean, his own worst enemy with the pills and the whatever. But one night I was at the, what were the awards they had in Sydney for show business?
The Helpmans.
No, the one for club people.
The Mo Awards?
That's the Mo Awards. And I'd never met him. And I'm standing there talking to somebody, and all of a sudden, this vision in pink. He was a pink. Walked towards me, getting closer and closer. And it was Johnny. I could hardly speak. I mean, I was still a teenage fan, yeah. I'm thinking, you know. And he came and said, I love you on the Mike Walt Show. You're so fun. He started talking to me. I could hardly. It's one of the few times in my life I was stuck for words. He was a star. He was Johnny O'Keefe. And he's talking to me and knew who I was. I could not believe it. And life was a tragedy. But you know what the lovely thing was? When the show opened, because we treated his first wife with kid gloves, because she put up with a lot, the poor darling. His son and daughter came up to us and said, gee, it was a lovely show. I said, I thought they were going to say, because you've got to be aware that could happen. And they said, it was lovely. They said, it was wonderful. You treat our mum so nicely. And I thought that was just wonderful. It was wonderful. And the show, of course, did very, very, very. And we were told before it opened, no one's going to see this show, Ben, old rock and roll star. And I said, want a bet? Well, not only did the golden oldies who grew up with Johnny O'Keefe were there, but kids were there. And what they all loved was seeing. I said, you know, this is your grandpa and grandma up there dancing around. That's what they weren't old fossils sitting in a wheelchair like they might be today. They're up there. That's where they spent their teenage. Well, that impressed a lot of kids to think that dear old Nana and Pop actually one day, long ago, were teenagers. The
kids, yeah.
And they loved that.
Yeah. A show you co-wrote with David Mitchell and Melvin Morrow.
My darling David Mitchell, who produced me for a while on the Mike Walsh show, as I told you before, a wonderful man, and Melvin, who's got a great talent. But David, of course, we were working together on the one. We became very close.
So collaboration's easy.
What I like doing is bouncing thing. I didn't with the Andrew Sisters show I've just written, which is going to be on in America in a year or so. I hope I live long enough to see it. The Americans have picked it up and love it, so I'm thrilled about that. But I did that by myself. But the art of collaboration is you bounce off each other. And you see a lot of great shows written by people who collaborated because, you know, I when I saw Chicago the other night, I thought, weren't Candra and Ebb brilliant?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
two of the greats.
Brilliant. I'd love to, and it made me think, oh, I wish John Frost would do Cabaret now. I'd love to see it again, you know. So, but David and Mel and myself bounced off each other. And then we did, of course, Dusty again, repeated, which was should have been an international hit, but was screwed up in many ways. And I've still got faith that one day someone will do it.
You had a West End season, didn't you? You had a West End season of Dusty, was that
well,
right?
What happened is everybody suddenly, when we said we're doing Dusty, they were doing Dusty. Oh, well, you know, that's a nice thing, but we're already doing one. This is what we're getting from producers overseas. They never did them,
right.
But they just they got the idea and thought, oh, maybe that's a good idea. But the people that did come up with Dusty Shows, the show, I hate to say it, sounds like an ego trip, but they were terrible shows. And so that's why none of them had legs. But our show had legs. It's still,
so it was a great show. It's still being
doing,
done. Yeah.
They're still doing it around Australia. And David and Mel have made some changes to it, but it's okay. And then I did Dream Lover, which was a big hit and would have kept running forever except David...
David Campbell.
Oh, that's his name.
That's his name. David Whatever happened to him?
He decided after the Melbourne season where you couldn't get... People were black marketing tickets in the lobby to see that show. I'm not kidding, it was packed every night. The investors in it, who were a couple, John and Barbara Gilbert, were thrilled to bits with the money they made out of, because they backed Dusty as well. They were thrilled to bits. But David didn't want to do it after the Melbourne season. And instead of it, which you would think would be common sense, instead of looking for someone who could do it, and I'm sure in our vast continent we have at least one or two boys that could have played that role, they said, oh no, we'll close it, David's leaving, so we're closing it. Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather because he's a licence to print money. And they closed it. Because you know what they learned? It was a simple show to do. You had the big band on stage. You didn't have any sets. You had props, no sets. And it was just, it was a good book. And it had, of course, memorable songs. And they just closed it. And I've never known why. I can't. We got an offer. You'll love this. We got an offer from America saying, we'd like to do Dream Lover. And I thought, that's good. Then said, but we want to do our own version. Now, we'll pay you like 2 and 6 if you let us do our version. But if there's any lines that may have come from your show or anything, any scenes, you won't be able to sue us for plagiarism. Mm. And I thought, you're cotton-picking mad. Then, in other words, they're saying, we could do your show and not pay you.
Yeah.
So I told them where to put their 2 and 6. And that was it, so it's never been done. But they wanted to. Now, I don't understand it because we had Americans see that show here who said, this should be on Broadway. This show is a Broadway show. It should be on Broadway. But just, you know what? People get greedy and they... And I've discovered one thing. A lot of people who are in the business of backing, of producing shows are not all that bright. No, I mean, you'd say, look, this show, they're packing them in everywhere. We'll do it. We'll do Australia tour. And then maybe we'll take it to New York. We'll take it to New York instead of wanting some New York. But they came back and said, oh, these people, the money they offered was a joke. I mean, you might have been able to buy an extra bottle of champagne at the supermarket for the money. I thought, this is, apart from anything else, an insult. But then saying, well, we'll do your show, but you can't sue us because we're going to get another writer in. And so the other writer come in and say, oh, this is easy, it's already there, put his name on it and do it. Forget it.
I read that you also explored the idea of a musical about Harold Blair, who was Indigenous.
Well, I gave up on that. I started to write Harold Blair, if people don't know, was a wonderful Indigenous, good-looking man. Gee, he was a good-looking man. And a wonderful singer. And was sort of a token. It was the first Aboriginal person to really be in the world of the arts, in the sense he was a tenor, wonderful tenor. And one little story where he was a cane cutter and the cane cutters put their money together to send him to singing school. The story's fantastic. And he became a great thing of taking Aboriginal kids from the bush and giving them a holiday and by the sea. A black American singer called Todd Duncan insisted he go to America and launch a career there, which he did. He packed concerts out in America, but was terribly homesick and came home. Fortunately for the family, because he left his wife and kids here while he went off to America. And he performed at the New York Town Hall with a packed United Nations audience, and he got cheering ovation and whatever. And then the ABC, when the ABC came back here, the ABC put him on a national tour and had him working day and night, and it ruined his voice.
Right.
It took, many people said after that tour, his voice was never the same. Never the same. But he became a voice coach at various kids' schools and a great fight for the Aboriginal cause, and, as I said, brought kids down from the country to have a swim in the bay. He was a wonderful man. And I thought, what a great idea for a story, because Marjorie Lawrence, you heard of Marjorie Lawrence?
Yes, absolutely.
Great Australian opera singer who was crippled by polio but came back on the stage wearing a support underneath her costume
to so help she could stand. Sing. Yeah.
And she was, I met Marjorie Lawrence in New York at some do in New York. She was an old lady, but lovely, lovely lady. And anyway, she was from Geelong and was a champion horse rider and would sing. And someone said, "No, Marge, you can sing a bit." And Marge sang around and eventually went to America and became a great Wagnerian singer, singing at the Metropole, the opera and whatever. And then was crippled by polio and made a comeback standing in this frame, whatever. But on one of her trips back to Australia, somebody got Harold Blair to sing for her, and she said, "You're wonderful. You're wonderful." And she was a great supporter of Harold's. And so it all leads up to going to America and coming up and what he did. Well, I wrote the thing, and I had Warren Wills, who's a composer, writing some original songs, because we used a lot of stuff from the bibliography of what Harold sang, but a lot of original songs about him growing up in a mission station with a leaky roof and a rotten floor and all those good, great songs. Anyway, Warren, who does a lot of stuff for the Aboriginal cause, he was telling somebody about it, and suddenly they said, "Oh, but Harold didn't do this and Harold didn't do that." Well, it was way back when, of course, you know, but now they expected to be out in the front line fighting, you know, the cause. Well, it wasn't that time. What he did brilliantly at that time. Yeah. So it all started getting political. And I thought, no, I don't want to get involved in this.
Yeah.
It's a lovely idea, but I can't be bothered with that sort of political stuff.
Yeah.
It belongs where it belongs. It doesn't belong in a music. And he didn't do enough for the cause. And Harold didn't. And Harold betrayed. Oh, give me a break. So I just stopped right doing it. That was it.
Fair enough. But another great story.
It is.
Another great story. John Michael, it's been such an honour to talk to you over this last hour.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
No. You're growing up, like many people around my age, we saw you daily on The Mike Walsh Show.
Oh, well, I love doing it.
And it was a time before the internet and all that sort of thing. Yeah. So you were our lifeline to Hollywood and entertainment. So.
Can I tell you a funny story? When Mike started, he was at Channel 10 before he went to Channel 9. And they couldn't get an audience. So they used to go around to the old folks' homes. And so, "Would you like to come and see a television show?" Well, they'd go anywhere. I mean, you know. So busloads would arrive of people in walking frames, wheelchairs and crutches and sticks, and come into the studio. Now, at the back of Channel 10 in Sydney, I don't know whether you know this, was a cemetery.
Oh, dear.
And our comment was, they can save a lot, they don't have to take them back. Just bug them. I have to say, life's been a laugh.
It has. You've got a terrific sense of humour. You get that from your Irish ancestors. Oh, the Irish,
they're all wonderful liars and wonderful storytellers and wonderful people to be with and kind and charitable. And I get my religious faith from that branch of the family, and I've never lost that. And I plead, I've sinned, and I'm not a sinner, I've sinned terribly. But it comes back. Eventually you think, why did I... When I was a little boy and I was innocent, why? And I go back to that sort of wonderful time where you trusted everything and believed everything. And I come back to that sort of second childhood. And I'm glad I have something to have. I feel very sorry for people who don't have an anchor in their lives. And that's why so many people are on drugs and drink, and because they have no anchor in their lives. It's like a lot of people who demonstrate. They're out demonstrating all the time because they have no anchor in their lives. That gives them a sense of purpose, laying down on the footpath or on the tram line. Some give, oh, I'm doing something for humanity. I'm laying on the tram line in Flinders Street and the world is coming to its knees and shaking because here I am sacrificing my time on the tram line. They're bullshit. They're full of it and they don't even know they're full of it. As if anybody, as if the climate's going to change because you're sitting on your bum on Bourke Street. Nobody gives a stuff. And with that, I'll go with a laugh.
Yes, we'll go with a laugh. There you go. What a way to finish. Thank you, John Michael.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks indeed, John Michael. It was an absolute treat chatting, and we wish you all the best for the Andrew Sisters musical in 2025. Before we depart, though, have you rated or reviewed the Stages podcast yet? It's easy to do. Just scroll to the bottom of the podcast listing, if you're in Apple Podcasts, and tick the star system. Then write a comment. This will help the podcast reach a broader audience and an ability to share the delights of the great stories and histories you hear in each episode. Thanks so much. Your assistance here is much appreciated. And thanks, too, for listening. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep warm, stay safe, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.